credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me a bit later will be Candace LaPage. Timing works out pretty nice sometimes because it is the week of Halloween and we've got Candace on to choose the movie of the week and review it with me. So, Halloween is in Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 4 days. And so it seems like a good time to watch horror movies. I, for one, have been enjoying a lot of horror movies lately because real life is a horror show. And if you're going to watch a horror movie, at least let it be 90 minutes long and about supernatural creatures who are eventually easy to overcome. That's my motto in these hectic days of pandemic, economic collapse, and American elections that could go horribly wrong. Stay tuned for more of that when you listen to Open Sources Guelph tomorrow. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new horror comedy message movie Vampires vs. the Bronx, which you can now stream on your Netflix app, wherever you may find that on your phone, your tablet, your smart TV, your computer, wherever. It's on Netflix. Anyway, that's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we are going to run this series on Halloween. So, not the Halloween holiday, but the Halloween movies, which started in 1978 with John Carpenter's Halloween and spawned 10 additional installments, which include sequels, retcons, remakes, and then another retcon. Anyway, so when you think about the Halloween movies, you get Halloween 1, Halloween 2, which Halloween 2 is a continuation of Halloween 1. Then you get Halloween 3, which is a completely separate story outside of the one established in 1 and 2. And then because that one wasn't as successful as the first two films, they brought Michael Myers back for 4, 5, and 6, which are all connected. And then you get to Halloween H2O, which retcons everything back to Halloween 2. So you get 1, 2, H2O, and then the H2O sequel, which is Resurrection. And then for the Halloween movie that came out in 2018, it retcons everything back to the original Halloween. So the films, in terms of following the story along, you get Halloween 1, and then Halloween into 2018, and then Halloween Kills, which was supposed to come out this month, but was postponed till 2021, October 2021, because of COVID-19. Alright, so shall we begin with the countdown, starting with the number 11th film, which is The Curse of Michael Myers. And a curse it is. It is notable for a couple of reasons. Notable for being one of the big breaks for Paul Rudd. And is notable for being the last film of Donald Pleasence, who played Dr. Loomis in 5 of the Halloween films. Probably the most recurrent star of the Halloween series. You know, the series, and we'll get there, starts out with just this idea of this guy who just kills young women for no apparent reason. And in Curse of Michael Myers, we get to this whole concept that there's this cult that depends on Michael Myers to, you know, realize this prophecy, and it is part of this, like, sort of rebirth cult that is connected to Samhain, the ancient pagan holiday upon which Halloween is based. It makes little to no sense. It creates this big, huge mythology for the character of Michael Myers that has never been addressed in any of the Halloween movies, and it's just is so nonsensical, right up until the very end, which was reshot, and had to be reshot, without the presence of Donald Pleasence, who died between the completion of principal photography and the reshoot. So they're like, this is a terrible ending, we need to reshoot it. Oh wait, one of the stars is dead and is kind of like the guy who's been the star of this series all along. And so, you know, you kind of realize why. You get to the end of Curse of Michael Myers and you get something quite horrible. Number 10 is Halloween Resurrection, which came out in the early aughts. It followed up on Halloween H2O, which brought back Jamie Lee Curtis to the franchise. She hadn't been in a Halloween movie since Halloween 2. And so we get with Resurrection the continuation of that story. And, you know, Halloween H2O ends kind of decisively. I won't spoil it, but it ends in a very decisive manner, which definitely says, like, this is the last Halloween movie ever, but because it was financially successful. You get Halloween Resurrection, which does have an interesting idea at the heart of it that it's taking place in the Myers home on Halloween. They've set up a kind of reality web show in that, run by Busta Rhymes of all cockamamie people. You know, you could be almost buy it if it weren't for the fact Busta Rhymes is Busta Rhyming all over this, but I digress. It is terrible, but at least it is laser focused on just being another slasher movie, which is credit I give Resurrection over Curse of Michael Myers, which is just craziness. Revenge of Michael Myers, which is part 5, I put at number 9. It's just another kind of pointless slasher. The end of Halloween 4 opened up a potential new realm that they could have been explored in this movie, but I guess between making Halloween 4 and Halloween 5, somebody just threw those ideas out the window and just said, let's make another Michael Myers slasher film. And that's what they did. And that's what you get with Halloween 5. In number 8 spot, I have the Rob Zombie remake of Halloween. And I did recently write a remake redemption about this for Nightmare on Film Street, which I think I was fairly generous in my appraisal of Halloween. But, you know, just the reality of it, it's one half prequel help to Halloween, and then it's one half Halloween remake, and so you end up getting something that doesn't follow through on those ideas particularly well, although there are interesting ideas in it. In one aspect, in one very slight aspect, find it interesting to sort of explore the psychological underpinnings of somebody like Michael Myers, what creates somebody like Michael Myers. It doesn't make a lick of sense, probably rationally, but that's okay. Rob Zombie was definitely trying here. He brought a lot of Rob Zombie flourish to it. I did like the casting in this. Scout Taylor Compton plays the new Laurie Strode, and I thought she did fairly well. And also casting Daniel Harris, who was Jamie Lloyd in Halloween 4 and 5, and making her a new character in the remake was a nice touch too. So Rob Zombie, clearly a fan. Clearly there was some thought put into it. I'm not entirely sure how successful it was. Number 7, I put Return of Michael Myers, which is part 4. This kind of reset things after Season of the Witch, which was the one Michael Myers-less entry. They bring in a new hero, Jamie Lloyd, who is supposed to be the daughter of Laurie Strode, Jamie Lee Curtis's character, and make her the heroine. Then becomes about like Michael Myers trying to eliminate his family, and they don't really kind of explain why, other than he just seems to be kind of a jerk that wants to kill everyone in his family. Well, okay. And then, like I said, the entry for part 5, there was a very interesting direction this all could have gone into, had they so choosed, following the end of Halloween 4. But again, nobody seemed to be interested, and they just kind of threw it all out the window to create another slasher film for part 5. And that seems to be kind of how this goes, or at least how the process goes, is that, you know, somebody comes in and creates some interesting ideas, leaves you a really interesting place to jump off from for the subsequent chapter, and then they bring in the next guy, and nobody cares. So at number 6, I have Halloween 2, which is the sequel to The Zombie, Rob Zombie film, released in 2009 after Halloween in 2007. I find this interesting. It's for Zombie, he's really interested in exploring what it's like for people to survive horror movie like circumstances, and that's what makes this interesting, as opposed to just doing like maybe a straight remake of Halloween 2, where it's like 1 year later. You see Laurie Strode really struggling, trying to be, after being like almost the sole survivor of the Michael Myers massacre, finding out she's Michael Myers' long-lost sister and other things. How does she cope with that trauma? How does she move on with her life after that? And then you have Malcolm McDowell as Dr. Loomis, but you have a thoroughly reprehensible version of Dr. Loomis who's trying to cash in on his notoriety and cachet of being Michael Myers' psychiatrist. When you watch it, there's some interesting stuff going on, and then there's other stuff about Michael Myers having visions of his dead mom and his younger self, and how they have to bring Laurie into this cult, maybe not a cult, but like this like killing tradition in the Myers family that just seems so silly, but it also seemed like Rob Zombie put it in there so he'd have an excuse to work with his wife, Sherry Moon Zombie, who was Michael Myers' mom in the first Halloween remake film. Number five, I have Halloween H20, which is the 20th anniversary. The 20 stands for 20. It was supervised by Kevin Williamson, who was very famous and hot at that point because of Scream and Dawson's Creek. Like, pretty much anything with teenagers and horror, they threw at him, and he sort of supervised this retcon remake Legacy Quill that brought, as I said, brought back Jamie Lee Curtis, erased everything between 2 and 6. And also introduced the world to Josh Hartnett, who was in almost every other movie for about 3 years. It brings back some of the mystery to Michael Myers. It hems very closely to the tone of the first film. Also interested in exploring ideas of trauma and post-traumatic stress. But so far as Halloween entries go, it is above mediocre, but it still feels like a fan product, like kind of like a fan film. Not that that's necessarily bad, but it could have done with a little bit more development. I mean, the part of the problem was it was very, very rushed because it was the 20th anniversary, and I guess somebody found out late it was coming up. Anyway, running out of time, so I do want to get to number four, which I did put Season of the Witch. Not a Halloween movie in terms of featuring Michael Myers. I think it is easily one of the best, just sort of taking it on its own. There's a very meta quality to it because Halloween is referenced as a movie that exists in this universe, so it is like separate and apart from the rest of the Halloween oeuvre, which is interesting. But it gets into sort of like the idea of about traditions about Halloween and ideas of, you know, harvest and sacrifice and a lot of really interesting stuff going on. There's mystery to it. Trying to figure out what just exactly is the what everybody is trying to cover up and why they're trying to cover it up and what the whole countdown with the silver shamrock and counting down to Halloween and what all that means. It's really, really interesting in terms of how this stands out in the series, and well worth revisiting, or visiting for the first time if you haven't before, because you may have avoided it because it doesn't involve Michael Myers. That brings us to Halloween 2 from 81. The thing that bothers me about this one is that it's a hospital on Halloween, but it seems dead. That never really made sense to me, but in terms of like bringing everything into a single setting, picking up from the previous film and continuing it, it's really great in terms of its pacing. It's not overly ambitious. It does feel of a piece, although there's definitely more artistry in the first Halloween. It definitely feels of a piece as a continuation. There is, of course, the famous twist where you find out at the end that Laurie Strode is Michael Myers' baby sister. Even John Carpenter has said that that was a mistake and came from a place of him like not really knowing what he wanted to do with a Halloween sequel. So there you go. It's no wonder why the filmmakers behind Halloween in 2018 kind of felt comfortable just casting that off and saying, you know what, maybe she's not his sister. And so that is number two, is Halloween 2018, which finally kind of took all these ideas about trauma that other films in the series have been playing with and kind of really distills it down into making it about... you know, ideas of family legacy and how trauma can be translated through generations, how the trauma of a matriarch can affect her daughter and her granddaughter. And it also, you know, no big mystery to Michael Myers. He's just a nutcase that wants to stab people. He's nobody's brother. He's you know, got no reason. It's just a freak accident of a bus crash lets him loose into the world. And, you know, his first stop is to get his mask and get a pair of overalls and then just start killing indiscriminately. Like, he really doesn't even sort of care when he finally comes face to face with Laurie Strode. It's like, oh, you again? Well, I guess we'll try and kill you. And it's really fascinating in that regards. Like, it doesn't explicitly talk about trying to get to the bottom of people's motivations, but it is quite good at talking about, like, how incidentally people are affected by traumatic events and how horror, you know, we're looking for a face to put on the horrible things that happen to us. And that's, in a nutshell, kind of what Laurie Strode was trying to do in the 40 years between the first film and the 2018 version. Still waiting for that sequel, and we'll have to wait till next year to see it. And that brings us to the number one spot, which is Halloween. And, you know, it's one of these cases where what more can you say about this film 40 years after the fact? The artistry is amazing. There's so many great filmmaking touches, a lot of things John Carpenter invented, the POV shot, wonderful. The simplicity of it, too. I think, you know, we want... filmmakers kind of want to overthink these slasher ideas so that you can set themselves apart and look how flashy and cool and innovative I am. There's still something about the simplicity of that first Halloween movie that just, it still works. It's still beautifully done. Jamie Lee Curtis became a star out of that, and understandably so, and her Laurie is just so down to earth and resourceful, and it's no wonder she kind of became the archetypal final girl, and all the final girls who came after her. Well, that was a lot to live up to, let's just say. A lot to live up to, in terms of segues. I will not try my luck there. We'll just move on to our review after a musical cue. And I realized we did Freddy Krueger movies a couple of weeks ago, and I should have played this song then, but I didn't. So I'm playing it now, because it's almost Halloween. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I was home all alone, but the TV was on. I thought nothing of it as I grabbed the remote. I pushed the power button, and then I almost choked when I heard this awful voice coming from behind. It said, "You are the living metal, and now you must die." Man, I ain't even wait to see who it was. Broke outside in my drawers and screamed so long, cuz got halfway up the block. I calmed down and stopped screaming, then thought, "Oh, I get it, I must be dreaming." I strolled back home with a grin on my grill. I figured since this is a dream, I might as well get ill. I walked in the house, the big bad Fresh Prince, but Freddy killed all that noise real quick. He grabbed me by my neck and said,
"What's poppin', y'all? It's your girl Gloria coming at you live. If you see a kid that's riding a bike two sizes too big for him, that's his little man trying to save the neighborhood. And speaking of saving the neighborhood, what's up with all these missing person flyers?
Yo, check out the courthouse.
They're turning it into apartments?
Y'all know how this starts. Them white people with canvas bags, that's always the first sign.
Hey, what you doing down here, bro?
It's too late to fight back now. We are going to wipe you out like the vermin you are.
We got vampires in the Bronx.
Nobody gonna care that Slim disappeared.
Why? Because he's a gangbanger?
Nah, homie. Because he's from the Bronx, like us.
There's a lot of things happening in this neighborhood right now. Keep your eyes open.
Huh? right.
Yo, that was mad vague, dog.
And that was a clip from Vampires vs. the Bronx, which is the new film from Oz Rodriguez, and it stars Jaden Michael, Gerald W. Jones III, Gregory Diaz IV, Sarah Ganon, Cliff Method Man Smith, Shea Whingham, and Zoe Saldana. And I'm now being joined on the line by Halloween expert Candace LaPage. Candace, how are you today?
I'm doing all right. I don't know how I feel about being called an expert in anything. How about an enthusiast?
Well, if it makes...
I don't necessarily know everything about it.
If it makes you happy, I think just of our panelists, you are probably the most horror inclined and most by virtue and then Halloween inclined following from that, because this is the time of year for horror movies.
Sure is. And by this, you mean like this entire month, right? All 31 days?
Absolutely.
At the very least?
Absolutely. But we are in the home stretch for Halloween. It is this Saturday, so it seems like an appropriate time for something fun and horror-like. And so we get Vampires versus the Bronx. And you pulled this one out of your magic Halloween hat. So why don't you start with... just why Vampires versus the Bronx sounded appealing to you?
Well, because it has vampires in the title. But obviously more than that. So I guess it showed up on Netflix maybe about 3 weeks ago or so. Probably at the beginning of the month, I guess. And I sort of had it on my queue. I should get around to watching this. But I will be honest, I have been... doing some old favorites this month, just to take advantage of the fact that it is October and there's nothing stopping me from watching a horror movie every single day. So it's been on my queue. And of course, Netflix puts it into many of my little algorithmically created strips because it's a horror movie with teens. So... you know, it ends up in my, like, suggested watching. It ends up things like scary movies for kids, teen comedies. It just ends up in all these different things that I keep watching. So, I'm like, oh, that's got to be on there. And, you know, it seemed fun, which I think is... first, not only important right now, you know, life is a little challenging, so it's nice to have fun things to watch. But it's also, you know, we watched Satanic Panic, right? Which was hilarious and lots mm-hmm. of fun, completely inappropriate for anyone like under the age of 18. So I was intrigued to watch something that was PG-13 that was clearly sort of made with a younger audience in mind, similar to The Babysitter and The Babysitter Killer Queen. While it's about sort of, it is a teen kind of comedy, it's not really, appropriate for certain ages. It's just a lot of blood and gore and violence. So I really wanted to see what a horror movie for a younger audience was going to look like and how they did it. And, you know, without giving away too much, I think they nailed it.
Yeah, it has been a good year for horror movies with inappropriate content for young people. but no, it's this is, I think, kind of age appropriate if you want something that is fun. That does have a kind of a horror spirit, but it's not too gory. I don't remember any really kind of explicit language, shall we say. If not, it's, you know, kind of like of the kids being kids variety of what, you know, how kids sound when adults aren't around. But yeah, it is interesting to take it from that perspective, that it is kind of like a nice new Halloween-y kind of film that you can, I hate to say, enjoy as a family, but it does have that spirit, that kind of Goonies spirit, that Monster Squad kind of spirit, where it is not It is not full of jump scares, it is not full of gore and stuff, but it is very, very referential to the genre while still being something everybody can enjoy all together.
Yes, yeah, for sure. And with the three sort of main protagonists, you know, their exact age isn't given, but I would, you know, it's probably somewhere between 12 and 14. Probably not quite into high school yet, but like right on the cusp of that. And the film itself takes place over the summer, I believe, because they do comment at one point about how hot it is, which was just a wee bit jarring for me as I was watching it. I was like, oh, here I am thinking of this as like a Halloween movie, and meanwhile it's set in the summer. Okay, well. But yeah.
There's a line where Gloria, who's constantly making these Instagram videos, says she says it's 95 degrees and it don't mistake it for sweat. It's just a glow. So it's it really kind of sets an image in your head of what it feels like outdoors. And it's definitely not a Halloween atmosphere.
No. But yeah, so with the three protagonists, I think they're sort of at that perfect age that, you know, kids who are sort of 7, 8, 9, depending, of course, on each kid has sort of their own like anxiety level with things that are a little scary. But, you know, younger kids like that can watch this and see themselves, you know, and who they're going to be when they're a little bit older. And then, you know, slightly older kids can sort of look back and, you know, think on their younger siblings or that sort of thing. Or I think it's they got the right age for these kids. I guess it's sort of like the Stranger Things sort of plan of attack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I mean, anytime you get a group of young preteens together, it's hard to shake the Stranger Things vibe. But yeah, it's their ages. There's a scene where they're talking to some older girls, and you know they're talking about, because the one boy, Miguel, who's kind of the leader, they call him Little Mayor, is talking to these girls about inviting them to this block party to save their local bodega. And when they kind of laugh them off, it's like, oh yeah, they're 16, so they're not, you know, the game isn't going to work on 16-year-old girls. So it perfectly captures that sweet little awkward phase. And to go back to the tone too, what it struck me as, I don't know if Oz Rodriguez, the director and the co-screenwriter, I'm not sure what his thoughts are about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but I got those kind of vibes, because it's when the vampires they have a vamp mode, to borrow that lingo, where their faces get all bumpy and crinkly, and the fangs are super exaggerated, and then when a vampire is killed, they burst into ash, which is using a very similar effect to both Buffy and Blade, which is also heavily referenced in the film. Mm-hmm. It's very, I guess, user friendly, I guess, is the thing I was looking at, where it's
recognizable.
It's recognizable, and it's also very, it makes a point of this isn't realistic. We're not going for a realistic tone here. This isn't I guess kind of like a True Blood thing, where, you know, the only difference between vampires and people is, you know, the vampires, when they vamp out, the fangs come out, and that's kind of the only real subtle touch there is to it. It makes the movie goes out of its way to say, like, they're monsters, so the violence is kind of in the context of, you know, we're fighting bad monsters who are trying to tear up our neighborhood.
Yeah, like, they're fantastical beasts. So, you know, they sort of die in fantastical ways,
right,
just to make sure that, yeah, to divorce it from some sort of violence, which, of course, is still something they imply and talk about in this film, because it is set in the Bronx, you know, and it's a sort of a more poor, sort of disaffected neighborhood. And, of course, you know, these kids are just on the cusp of you know, becoming more mature, you know, kids who are going to make decisions around their future. And there's the sort of, you know, local gang who are trying to recruit one of the three friends into their ranks. And yeah, you know, the fact that there is always that sort of threat of violence there, whether it's, you know, from those members to our protagonists, or, you know, actually to be done to other people. So yeah, I think it's a nice balance of making the violence that these kids, you know, sort of dish out to the vampires is really not the same thing at all. Like they really do a good job of making it like a totally different thing that, as you say, is easier to sort of swallow, I guess.
Right. And that's a very tight rope to walk. And I think that's the same boy, Bobby. I can't remember if it was his father was killed. It's implied his father was a member of the local gang, and his father was either killed or his father's doing a very long sentence in jail. But either way, you know, the local violence is has you know, affected the kids, obviously, and the two other kids, Luis and Little Mayor, obviously, because they're friends with Bobby, understand its effects too. So yeah, it's great that the film does underline that there's a difference between, you know, sort of the gang violence and the film kind of, I guess, has going on in the background, and the pretend fantasy kind of violence of fighting vampires. And and it also helps, like the vampires are very caricatures, like with their silver hair and dark clothes,
the long coats.
Yeah. It's very what they what we do in the shadows kind of vampirism. Even Shea Wingham, who plays like their familiar, has this like kind of ridiculous hairstyle where it's just like poofed up, and he's kind of wearing the clothes and wearing them kind of very awkwardly because he's a vampire wannabe. But it's fun. It's fun. It's the lines are very clearly drawn.
And so I will say, it's interesting that you sort of bring up Buffy the Vampire Slayer, because I did not go that way at all with this. This film to me was so completely a remade version of Fright Night, and like perfectly done as far as I'm concerned. But you know, where Fright Night was, you know, a younger boy. I think he was a little bit older. The character, I can't remember his name, but the character was a little bit older, I think, than these three main characters. But you know, his next door neighbor is a vampire, and it's more, you know, it really tells you about the different lifestyle that we're in right now, because Fright Night was about the paranoia of the suburbs and about how people stopped living sort of in neighborhoods and as a community and started having their own individual, like, this is our house and this is our lot and this is our backyard. And, you know, we drive home, get out of our car, go into the house, and if we're doing anything outside, we're doing it in the backyard and nobody can see us. And so you have this whole like area where there are a ton of people living there, but nobody really knows each other. Everything happens behind closed doors and closed drapes, and maybe the neighbor really is a vampire. And so it was really about that sort of, you know, paranoia. It's basically the same film, except the paranoia or the anxiety, the worry isn't about the suburbs and about people not knowing each other. It's the gentrification, right? It's about getting essentially like violently expelled from your community because somebody else wants it. And it's interesting because I think I really liked that part of the story a lot. I think that it was very funny in some parts and very touching in other parts, you know, as the parents were trying to explain to the kids, like, you know, things change. It's okay. Like, we'll get through this. It's not the end of the world if, you know, a restaurant opens up your favorite nails place or something. But I do think that there's just a little bit of confusion around that idea, because in some ways, the vampires who are moving in say that they don't want to change the neighborhood because it is a neighborhood that's full of violence and forgotten people, and so nobody cares if anybody goes missing. But as they slowly gentrify, how is that going to remain? That's going to change. Maybe they don't plan on actually opening any of those companies that they have put up signs for. Maybe they're just putting up signs and that's the end of it. I don't know.
You mean they weren't going to open a butter store?
That was great. I did. There was honestly so much comedy around gentrification issues. The thread and bone place and the two guys in front going, I know, right? Is it a restaurant? What is it? Who knows?
Yeah, yeah. No, the gentrification angle is interesting too, because it's also an allegory for vampirism, where it's like you essentially stay the same, but everything on the outside is kind of changed. It, you know, you become a creature of the night. You drink blood to survive, but you never age. You know, so essentially how you are in the moment when you become a vampire is what you are going to be forever. And it is often sold as this idea that being a vampire is better, but there is always somebody in a lot of these vampire films, there's always somebody who says, yes, I would like to be a vampire. That is such a better, more fulfilling thing to be. But there's always somebody who's also there pointing out, well, you know, you become a monster and you drink blood and you live forever, and that's not a very human quality, to the idea of being immortal. So the gentrification angle does have a nice connection to vampirism too, because you can see the good but you can also see the bad. And of course, you know, the kids being kids, all they kind of do is see the bad. They see it as, you know, just somebody moving in and kicking Becky out of her nail salon, kicking Tony out of his corner store. And you know, you see it makes it very tangible too, because, you know, Tony is seen, you know, he's trying to bring in like high quality hummus and oat milk to his to his bodega just to try and adapt. And it, you know, it really does seem like it's a struggle that even he he's accepted to extent he's probably going to lose, even if little mayor and friends aren't there yet.
Yeah, they aren't ready to give up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did not take me very long into watching this movie just to be so glad that I pressed play on it. It was so well done. It was so well acted. These three actors playing the, you know, Miguel and Bobby and Luis are really, they're very strong actors. I was really impressed by them.
I like that they have this very strong trinity at the center of the film, and that it's not just about... I guess there's a lot of really interesting complications too, because, you know, they're not just, you know, sort of the Stranger Things kids, you know, to solve this like a great mystery. That, you know, they have their interpersonal dynamics at play. They are not exactly latchkey kids either. They have very strong parental influences too, and they feel bound by that. They feel bound by their connection to Tony and wanting to do right by him. And
even the church too. Yeah. Right? We haven't really talked about that, but
right. And that's, I mean, that was great. Having Method Man as the local priest. It's a nice bit of, you know, institutional rehab for the Catholic Church to have like a strong, upstanding priest who is trying to keep kids on the straight and narrow, as opposed to, you know, what some priests have been accused of in real life, but just method, having Method Man's presence in the film and having his priest character as this kind of no-nonsense, you know, kind of like the stern black lieutenant that's in every cop movie. He was bringing that kind of energy.
Like a drill sergeant for these kids, you know, just trying to keep them in line. But I think, you know, not only his character and obviously, you know, their sort of ailing relationship with going to church, but Luis's grandmother, because they're Puerto Rican, and presumably his grandmother is very, very religious. So, you know, there's a little bit of that. But then one of the characters, of course, Miguel starts telling people immediately that they're vampires. He actually, you know, witnesses a vampire killing someone, and so is telling people all the time, to varying degrees of, I think that you're going a little bit a little bit crazy. We're not too sure, you know, what you're trying to do here. But sort of the first character to really sort of come around, you know, talks about how she's Haitian. She's like, I'm Haitian. Like, we've been training for this our whole lives.
Right.
So, you know, and not to totally give away the ending, but obviously this doesn't end, you know, in a real, like, horrible bloodbath. So a lot of the neighborhood really comes together to save their own neighborhood. And I think a big part of that does sort of come back to, you know, certainly the community side, but with that sort of deep thread of religion and faith, and, you know, in some ways the melting pot of religions that is going to be present in the Bronx, where it's maybe a little bit easier for them to sort of go, huh, okay, vampires, sure, that could be.
Well, it's also kind of reinforced that the Bronx isn't exactly the best place in the city, and it has long been exploited as, you know, it has been for a long, I mean, the further north you go in New York is kind of where the more minority areas are, when you get into Harlem, and then through Harlem into the Bronx area, that's kind of where, you know, through gentrification, you know, all the minority communities in the city have, at least in the Manhattan portion of the city, have been pushed, and yeah, it's, the way it's kind of greeted, although Miguel is greeted with some degree of skepticism at first, it does become very easy, because the resignation of the people there is like, of course vampires are going to come to the Bronx to settle and then take over our neighborhood, and you know, it becomes a matter of, you know, not just we don't want monsters in our neighborhood, you know, we don't want monsters around. It's a matter of civic pride, of standing up for the Bronx, of somebody finally taking a stand for the Bronx. And that's, you know, that's kind of a spirit in a lot of, like, New York movies. Like, I'm thinking about, like, Ghostbusters, which, you know, maybe it's not hard to not think about Ghostbusters and in this context, but that, you know, this spirit of, like, you will not inflict your supernatural evil on New York, but I mean, here it's very centered on the Bronx, which I feel like would be the butt of a joke in something like a movie like Ghostbusters. But, you know, it's very much there very much is a sense of place, and that I enjoyed too. And it's been a really good year, I think, for, like, the underappreciated aspects or the underappreciated areas of New York. So, like, the King of Staten Island is one example, but also a movie we reviewed a couple of weeks ago, Peter and I, the 40-year-old version, which is very much about Harlem and the changes in that area as well. So it's been a good year for underappreciated places in New York.
No more watching Gossip Girl for your New York fix. It's not all about the Upper East Side.
No, sadly, no. But I mean, there are reasons not to watch Gossip Girl. that I will.
I don't know any of them. I Unguilty.
I watched
fan.
It till the end. Yes, I watched it till the end, and there are reasons. But moving along, I want to highlight. We highlighted Method Man. We highlighted the kids. We highlighted Shea Whingham. I think we also need to highlight Sarah Gadon as the also, you know, local Canadian actress, not local to Guelph, but local in Canada. Big place, I grant you, but we have to.
Just from Toronto, that's very near us.
It's close enough, yeah. No, so to have her in here as the well-meaning white woman who is more than happy to be in the Bronx and gentrifying it for reasons we will find out later in the film that are kind of spoilery, but not unsurprising, I will add. Yeah. But she was a lot of fun, too.
Yeah, she was great. Certainly, you know, through her first, you know, three sort of appearances, it's kind of like, yeah, what is the deal? She's making it very clear that she's not, you know, one of those white people who just wants to come in and take over your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So what is going to happen? And so it was, I think they could have gone a number of different ways with her character. I'm not going to say which one they did, but I think that there were definitely, you know, there were definitely a variety of ways they could have gone with, you know, what a new person to the neighborhood is going to be like when suddenly there are also vampires in the neighborhood.
Yeah, and she sticks out like a sore thumb because she's a middle-class white woman in the Bronx, but also for the longest time in the movie, she's the only white person we see that is not one of the vampire gang. So it is an immediate clue there, shall we say. I just also want to highlight that speaking of like the religion aspect, because a lot of vampire movies now ignore the religious aspect because I guess it's not cool to, you know, use crosses and holy water anymore, but it does find a lot of really fun ways to use the mythology of vampirism. You know, things like them not having a reflection, which comes in very handy when the kids are trying to get videotape evidence. And the stuff about like the holy water. There was a really great effect in the film where they have water balloons filled with holy water. And it's mentioned that the holy water starts to boil when you're close to a vampire, and there's a really great practical effect with the water boiling in the water balloon that I found really neat from a technical perspective, and kind of really appreciated that kind of simple ingenuity that you can get sometimes in these smaller films.
Also appreciated that particular part. It's one of those, you know, those sort of things where, you know, it's good scripting, right? They scripted a line in earlier on that talked about how holy water boils when you're near a vampire, and then it paid off and it was great, you know, because there were other things that they sort of put in there that, oh, actually, no, maybe they did use them all because they did talk about the garlic. And there was one part, I think, where someone threw a bunch of garlic powder at one of them, if I can remember.
Yeah.
So I think they really did use all of the different ways that were sort of introduced as ways to repel vampires.
Yeah, and it's I read online somebody commented that that type of garlic powder is used a lot in Puerto Rican cooking, and of course it's Luis who takes it from his grandmother's kitchen, and so I mean there's a lot of kind of winky knowy things like that to like the cultures as you said make up the boiling pot of the Bronx that only someone who is kind of like part of that culture can sort of truly appreciate. And it all comes together very beautifully in this package. I mean, there's great messaging, there's great casting, great characters. It's fun. It doesn't take itself too seriously, and it's tight. It's like 90 minutes long, and it's like short, punchy. There are a lot of great one-liners. And Lorne Michaels produced this, which caught me by surprise.
Yeah, well, so it turns out the writer-director is one of the writers for Saturday Night Live. So I think he probably just did a really good job of using his network, which good for him. That's what you do.
Yeah, use the network.
Yeah.
And, you know, it goes to show there's still, pun not intended, some life in the vampire genre. There was one review I read where somebody said nobody should be making serious vampire or zombie movies at this stage of the horror cycle, and I would tend to agree. And I do like these sort, not to say that they're unserious, but I do like these unserious kind of horror. This also reminded me a lot of a movie I saw years and years ago called Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Undead, which is about vampires basically taking over this staging of the Tom Stoppard play. But it's also like it's also an indie vampire movie that's also a comedy, but it's also set in New York. And it just, you know, there's a lot of fun you can have with these movies, and I think if there's, like, if the worst thing you could say about Vampires versus the Bronx is that it's fun, I think that's a compliment worth taking.
Yeah, I think if that's what you can say, then it achieved its goals.
Yes, it did. And so well worth seeking out on the Netflix there. And probably a more satisfying thing to watch than Antebellum, which was another one of the things on our list, but probably not as, probably more, I don't know, directly pointed in its commentary, but probably not as fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I will say I was very excited to watch that back when the trailer came out, some of the reviews I've heard have made me less likely to press play on it. Mm-hmm. We'll see. You know, it's always, it seems almost like even more of a disappointment. And this is the problem we have with so few black-led movies, that each one feels like it has to be perfect and great, because there are so few of them. And you know, when one doesn't quite work out, unfortunately it skews the ratio because it's already skewed. So,
right.
It's a real problem with the fact that we just can't get enough diversity in big blockbuster films to begin with. So every time something comes out, it has the weight of the world on it. And, it sounds like so far Antebellum did not carry its share of the weight.
Sadly, no, but we do still have Vampires versus the Bronx, and that will draw Halloween month to a close, at least for the show. So, Candace, if people want to get in touch with you and talk about Halloween in these last fleeting hours of October, how can they find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me anywhere on the internet at Sin48, especially on Twitter, where I do seem to be, tweeting almost every day about whatever film I'm watching. It feels like I've been watching a lot, way less Star Trek content on my Twitter than there is horror right now. So that's a good place to have a good conversation about what's going on in the horror world. And every once in a while, you can also tune in to the Village by the Bookshelf, which is the podcast about book reading, where I continue to soldier on reading every book by Stephen King. I have been reading The Stand for at least 3 episodes now, and we put out our episodes monthly. So it's a big book.
Yes, it is. And you may finish it just in time for the new miniseries of The Stand that comes out.
I might. That would be exciting.
That would be exciting. And that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it, and if you want to listen to it again, and why wouldn't you? You can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. Download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean, or you can get it through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. While you're on Spotify, you can also find the playlist of all the music you hear on End Credits, and you can just go on Spotify and search End Credits on CFRU for that playlist, and let her rip, although it's not all Halloween music. I should make that note. You'll have to find a separate playlist for Halloween music. You can find us on social media, on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back here on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. You can go to my political site, guelphpolitico.ca, and you can read my writing about horror movies at Nightmare on Film Street at nofspodcast.com. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for more end credits. Not so much Halloween, but definitely more end credits. And we will see you then.